Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Fresh from the Hill, Inside Stories of Noteworthy Cornellians. My name is Abigail Macaluso, class of 2020, and I am one of the co-authors of Wall of Wonder, Cornell Women Leading the Way in Science, Technology, and Engineering, now available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. To learn more about the book, check out the first episode of this season. Today, I am here with one of the amazing, innovative women featured in Wall of Wonder, Joanna Dye, class of 2008. Joanna is the co-founder and CEO of Dye, a performance wear brand for the professional woman based in London. Previously, she was a vice president at JP Morgan before making the switch to fashion. Welcome to the podcast, Joanna.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're so excited to have you here. Thanks for being a part of this. And I wanted to start off just by taking us back to your days before and at Cornell. In the book, we talk a little bit about how you chose to study electrical and computer engineering, also known as ECE, because it's one of the hardest majors that you can find. And I would love for you to tell us a little bit more of where this drive came from.
I, growing up, always loved math and science. I think those were my stronger areas going all the way through high school. And my dad, who is a mechanical engineer, encouraged me to pursue a technical degree and get a technical skill set. And so engineering seemed like a natural fit. And when I joined Cornell, it was in 2004. And to me, it felt like electrical and computer engineering or computer science seemed more like the future in terms of the industry. And I guess I wanted to do something that was more tangible. So I went with ECE. And I also, when I was applying for schools, really wanted to flip gender diversity on its head and thought, if I could apply for a degree where there were so few women, one, hopefully it worked to my advantage to get into some of these prestigious programs. But two, I just wanted to, you know, really challenge that and break the mold and join a major that had little to no women. So there I was.
Amazing. I think a lot of us engineers definitely relate to a lot of that. And today, you know, the college likes to say that we are 50-50. And I think even within majors, it definitely does vary. Maybe you could share a memory or an experience that you had at Cornell being one of the few women in ECE.
Yeah, I think at the time I could literally count the number of women in my degree on one hand. I think there were literally five of us. And I still had such a blast in terms of the people that, and the talented, intelligent people that I got to work with. I think one particular memory that comes to mind was we had to complete our project for EC 476, which was for us building a robot with a neural evolutionary algorithm. And we ended up staying up for two nights, all-nighters, getting it done because obviously we procrastinated the project. But me and my partner, Dave Drew, had just such a great time doing it and building and splitting the work in terms of both the mechanical, like electrical, and the programming part of it, and being able to see the success of the robot, being able to like learn to avoid hitting the white wall of the little arena we built for it over time. That was one of the most rewarding things and one of the most memorable projects that I did in ECE.
I definitely think a lot of engineers remember their late nights in Duffield or wherever their home base was. Totally relate to that. Amazing. And moving forward from Cornell Engineering to your first job at JP Morgan, could you take us through that a little bit and explain how you kind of pivoted from engineering to finance?
Yeah. So I spent my sophomore summer as intern at Hewlett-Packard in San Diego. And back then, you know, to have an internship at HP as a sophomore, I was like, oh my God, I've scored the jackpot, and had a great summer living the beach lifestyle, great work-life balance, was on the softball team in the summer league. And I think what I got out of that was one, a great experience and really eye-opening in an electrical engineering-based company that was like a huge Fortune 500 company. But it also taught me that I really craved to be on like a fast-paced trading floor environment. So when I got back to school and was looking for jobs for junior year summer, I actually applied for a bunch of finance jobs and landed as an intern at Bear Stearns in 2007. And that led to a full-time offer. But as many of you will know the history, in the spring of 2008 was when Bear got bought by JP Morgan at a very low price per share. And I was on spring break in Cancun when the news happened and thought I was literally out of a job. And I was like, shoot, like I need to line up another job. It turned out, luckily in some ways, that JP Morgan extended offers to all of the Bear Stearns hires. And then they had the summer analyst training in two different waves. So I asked HR to put me in the first wave because I thought if I landed, got my foot in the door earlier into my full-time position at JP Morgan going into the summer of 2008 and fall of 2008, I had a better chance of at least holding on to a full-time role. Like, we all knew things were really cracking and we were heading into financial crisis, and there was definitely a high probability of me losing my job at that point. But I still wanted to pursue it and at least have some experience with JP Morgan. And it ended up playing out such that probably like 50% of my analyst training class was let go in the fall of 2008. And I was just also just so lucky that I was in a group on a team where they kept me on through that period. It wasn't my ideal job in a bank, but it was lucky that I sort of survived during all the, you know, turmoil that happened during that time, kept my head down. And after that happened, as soon as it felt like it was starting to, you know, within the environment in the bank starting to settle, I was networking with senior women. I was looking for a sales job on the trading floor in terms of sales and trading in the market side. And 9 months after I joined from the training program, there was an opening and I interviewed, and then that's where I landed the job in interest rate derivatives on the sales side, doing deals with the biggest corporate clients of JP Morgan. So, and that led me to a 5-year experience in New York with JP Morgan. So I think, you know, part of it is being that experience taught me, you know, keeping your foot in the door, like being able to network was always really important. And then being a part of a culture at that time where JP Morgan really navigated and came out of the crisis on top was also really inspiring. And also I think, you know, being surrounded by those types of people, some of my best friends today are from JP Morgan and from the years that we all sort of grew up in that culture together.
Yeah, definitely. I think especially right now in this moment, a lot of young grads like myself can relate to that moment. And we're learning a lot of these great skills that you really need to, you find out that networking is like the most important thing, and that that's how jobs will come out of this situation, and you'll get through it, and you'll get through it with other really great people that will become a really strong part of your network in the future.
Yeah, exactly. I completely agree with that.
Yeah, awesome. So as you mentioned, you had this great experience those 5 years working in New York, and then you moved to London, taking on more of an international role. You were flying all across Europe, working really long days. And it was in those couple last years at JP Morgan that the idea for DAI comes out of. Can you kind of take us through that aspect, that part of your career?
Yeah. I, like many women, again, in a male-dominated environment, you know, was working long hours for me. It was a lot of running around the trading floor or same-day work trips, first flight out in the morning and a day pounding the ground, going to meetings, seeing clients, and then coming back on the last flight. And I always loved to look smart and feel confident with what I wore. But I realized that the clothes were not really designed to keep up with us. Like, these women who were ambitious on the go trying to break the glass ceiling, especially in the fabrics that were being used that were restrictive and didn't feel that comfortable and also wrinkled really easily. You had to dry clean them. And it was one of these days I had a 4 a.m. cab pickup from Heathrow, a day of meetings in Stockholm. And on the flight coming back, which was the last one, I didn't get home until like 11 p.m. I was sitting in my seat and I was thinking, like, my waistband is really tight. My arms from the blazers are really uncomfortable. And I just, everything felt restrictive. And then I thought to myself, can this feel like yoga and still look like a power suit? Imagine how empowering that would feel, or imagine all the times where we needed our focus the most to deliver our best performance. And if there's something in the back of your mind that's like, this is really uncomfortable, your mind's not focused on delivering what you need to say to a room full of senior bankers and clients and really like having that moment to shine through. And so I imagined and wanted to build a brand where clothes didn't restrict us, but rather empowered us, a brand where comfort empowered confidence so that women can succeed. And we know that statistically, the world is better when women succeed. So that was the idea or the spark at the time on that flight. And I know we're going to get into this, but you know, what is a path that leads someone from finance to fashion? It was definitely not a straightforward journey and one that I discovered and kind of made my own path.
Yeah, amazing. I love your tagline of comfort, empowered confidence. I think it's just so fabulous. And so many women identify with it. And as you briefly mentioned, I'd love to jump into, you have this spark, but how does one take that plunge and make that giant step? And as somebody, I also, just as an engineer, we like lists and we like how to do things. And there's really no how to guide on starting your own company per se. How did you take the plunge?
Yeah. I think like most ideas that have that spark, if it sticks with you and keeps you up at night, and you keep thinking about it and really being like, this is lacking in the market, it just stuck with me for a long time. I didn't actually have like an execution plan or a list or to do, you know, how to get from A to B at the point in time. But at the same time, it was 8 years into my career in finance, and I felt an urge to be more entrepreneurial, be more creative, get back into that side of me, which I really enjoyed doing. Like back at Cornell, I was also the class of 2008 president, and I loved being able to do, you know, coordinated events, bring the class together, express my creativity in that sense. When I came to 8 years after banking, I really wanted to create something that had more of a direct, tangible impact every day. And so that was the path that led me to take some time out, figure out what I wanted to do next. It led me to get in touch with my drawings and watercolor again, and that gave me enough confidence to sign up for design and pattern cutting classes at the London College of Fashion. And then after that, all the young 20-something year olds in the class were going for unpaid fashion internships. This is what you did to get experience and have a great designer name on your resume. So I did the same thing, but as a 30-year-old. And I asked my wedding dress designer in London if I could intern for her unpaid for 3 months. The designer is Amelia Wickstead. So she's got a beautiful brand, very high-end, dresses celebrities and red carpet and the whole like runways, British Fashion Week, all of that. I was able to jump in with an 8-year experience in banking and really act more like a consultant in terms of analytics, processes, reporting, data across all the different departments. And for me, it was the best experience to learn what it was like inside of a fashion company. And be humble enough to know that I'm stepping into a new industry. I need to learn from the ground up, and I'm happy to do it unpaid because for me, it was an education. And then after that, I started going to the world's largest textile exhibits, sourcing from only the best, most innovative performance fabrics on the market at the time. And at that point, I had, through the networking I did in fashion in London, met my first product development person, 30 years experience working with luxury British women's wear, and a pattern cutter. And she and I tested all of these technical athletic fabrics for the best performance and tailoring construction. And then with that, I had an 8-piece collection that I designed, and we launched that. So from the end of my internship, I really hit the ground running. And within 4 months, we launched the website dyewear.com with all the branding, 8 styles, everything in 2 colorways. So we had 16 styles on the site, the Instagram, the sort of like the whole experience, everything I did on pre-order, because as an entrepreneur, what you want to do is test and iterate and build your minimum viable product. And for me, that was the first collection, but I also didn't want to invest in stock until I knew women were willing to pre-order and pay for this price point for the product. And I did trunk shows in New York and London with my network and sort of 1 degree. And when I saw that people loved, and I had prototypes and size sets of everything, people were willing to order not one, but up to 5 of the first 8 styles. I was like, this is telling me something. It's great. And then one of the women who came to the trunk show went back, knew someone who knew someone who wrote for the Times in London, was a columnist. And that columnist got in touch, tested everything, loved it. And the first article she wrote was so amazing. It was praising our trousers. Like, I found the perfect trousers. Every single word was dedicated to our pants. And we sold out. Like, when that article ran, we sold out before I woke up that morning. I put the website back on a pre-order. And, you know, over the weekend and over the following week, we had several hundred pre-orders for an unknown brand without a delivery date on the website that I had to go and figure out. So that was incredible and kind of put us on the map.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's so much tremendous marketing for zero cost. And yeah, you're selling out. And how do you keep up with that demand? I would feel like I was just like running on a treadmill that you can't keep up with.
How did we keep up with the demand? I think the pre-order allowed me to calculate and have cash coming in to fund the larger volume coming through. And then I ordered a little bit more at the time for extra stock. And then with the first like 12 to 18 months, really without a marketing budget and bootstrapping everything, the press was our marketing engine. So from the Times, we were featured in the Telegraph, the Financial Times, the Economist, the Guardian, the Independent, Fast Company. Then I was invited to go on TV and be interviewed. And so, like, we kept selling out. We were not keeping up with the demand, and especially without extra capital. I think we were just growing, but bit by bit. And I felt at that point that, yeah, like the fact that every time we sold out, I ordered double the quantity as the time before to keep up with whatever cash was coming in to buy stock. We kept selling out again, that, you know, it warranted thinking about, am I actually servicing the demand as quickly as I needed to be? Should I be considering, you know, bringing in external capital to help support and really give the brand and the company the fullest potential that I was experiencing?
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's like a very dramatic increase in growth and how to handle hiring and people and just all the things that you've never really had to manage before. How did you tackle that?
I think it was a huge learning curve for sure. And even the first 3 months of the brand were different than the months 3 to 6, 6 to 12, like the company was growing and evolving so quickly. And at the same time, because it's a product-based company rather than services or software, like there is a constraint on where the cash flow goes. It has to go into inventory, first of all. And so I think we had to be really smart about how to manage resources and hires. I was always looking for talented people for full-time initially, and still now, like hiring those really bright junior people who were really hungry and believed in the brand, and then using those very talented, creative, and skilled people still today as part-time or consultants or independent contractors of the company, where I, you know, really look to their experience where I lack, because I don't come from that world of design or art direction, beautiful imagery, and, you know, photography, and relying on them to bring the skill set, but then not being able to have them on quite as full-time as yet. And we're still getting towards that point. But also the journey along the way, technology has been a huge part of it, because we launched day one as a direct-to-consumer e-commerce brand. And with the platforms available out there today, Instagram democratizing, you know, marketing, like anyone can build a brand and build a community, or very organically now, those have also very much helped the journey and help us scale much faster than otherwise in previous times or previous, you know, decades.
I wanted to ask a little bit about how you are really like redefining the space in retail for women, and how you call it performance wear, and your store experience seems really unique, and you have a technology called Dye DNA, and just talk a little bit about how you're really merging tech and fashion.
Yeah. So for me, I mean, performance wear for women who mean business was and is the original tagline. It's the original saying, because I see it as performance in the clothes and in the fabrics, enabling and empowering the performance of this woman, the one who is really ambitious, bold, wants to do something professionally and achieve successes in her career and personally in her life. And so the brand evolves around performance. The store experience and then the evolution of what's called Dye DNA, I think also came from a really organic place, because the first collection I designed was only 8 styles. And I think I had the inherent bias of designing styles that best suited my body shape. And I just didn't know, you know, until I announced it and launched it, that most women are not like, I'm a column shape, and most women will be somewhere between an hourglass and a pear, and we have the data to back that up now. But as soon as I knew that the first collection was quite limiting and not every single customer could come and buy into our brand because we didn't have the silhouette or the style for her, the next 3 collections focused on expanding our range in a way that did cater to more body shapes. And the acceleration of, or I guess like perhaps this is where the engineering side of me really sees an opportunity, is how do we codify this like logic of, okay, if your height is this, your shoulder width is this, and your hips are this, like there's an easy way to put a logic and algorithm into that and be able to tell a woman what body shape she is, and then therefore recommend the best styles on our site, and also based on our stylists and in-person experiences with customers and feedback that we've gotten. How do we make that on the website an easy journey and a fun journey for our customers to find the best fit for them? And then also display that result of what we recommend in her actual body shape, in someone who's a model who's most representative of what the product would look like on her. And so that was the first step, was our trouser fit finder. And we just saw that there was so much potential in starting with something quite simple and bootstrapped, but still proprietary in our algorithm. Like there was a whole platform that was based on all the technology and services that we offer that are fit and body shape related. And when we were playing around with what should we call it, you know, we were like, it's our DNA fit to your DNA. So it's the Dye DNA. And so that is now the platform under which everything, the fit finder, the body shape finder in store, we've got this on iPads, we've got it on pillars and in installations of displays of your body shape. So in store and online, and especially when we went into lockdown, we launched it virtually. It just seemed like such a beautiful way to show it. And it was also very telling when our in-store installation, there's like 5 pillars. We've got illustrations of different body shapes. Also, it'll be like envision, you know, if you're pear-shaped, you're like, you know, Michelle Obama, or you visualize real ambitious women. And then you're like, I get it. And then we recommend these styles. When we post that on our Instagram, and the insights nowadays are also like really transparent, but that was like our most saved post ever. And we were like, okay, we're on to something. And we did a cropped image of it. So a lot of women were direct messaging us asking, can you send me the whole thing? Can you send me the whole thing? So I think we stumbled upon a little nugget there that really is relevant. And maybe a lot of brands, like for sure, a lot of brands are not really showing how to dress for your shape in that way. And I think it's something that we really want to expand into.
Yeah, it's definitely like about time that we're leveraging technology to allow for a full different set of body types to have be just able to find more inclusive fashion in the space. So yeah. I love what you guys are doing. And another amazing aspect of the brand as well is your sustainability efforts. And I wondered if you could talk to that.
Yes. So when I launched and started building the supply chain in 2017, and the whole foundation of the brand was on the basis of creating positive impact. And for me, I already knew, like, number one, it was empowering women. But without, like, with a blank canvas to create a supply chain in a company and seeing what was already like the trends or the undercurrents of the dialogue in fashion from the production side, sustainability was a huge topic. I mean, and then once I opened the Pandora box on fashion being the second biggest polluter as an industry on the planet, how fast fashion has really just resulted in so much pollution in the industry, I wanted in every way possible to do the best that we could in everything that we could build into the company. And it starts with the raw materials, yes, but I think even before that, I knew that from the design perspective, it was based on timeless classic silhouettes, building pieces that were high quality and durable and stood the test of time in our customers' wardrobe. So first of all, it was the consumption and the basis for the design being timeless. And then when we looked at all of our raw materials and then the partners and suppliers and factories who we worked with, it's like the first main fabric supplier that we found that created the tailoring look, but with all the performance in the fabrics. This factory based in Italy had been around for 60 years. They were always investing into technology that reduced and recovered water usage. Their entire factory is powered by renewable energy sources and solar panels. They recycle 30 million liters of water a year. And it was mind-blowing. And everything they do is third-party independently eco-certified for chemical safety and the non-use of harmful chemicals to your skin. And once that was identified as our main supplier and that's where the credentials were, like, I turned around and looked at everything else we were sourcing, whether it's the zips, the buttons, the threads. And it was actually, I think, much easier to find in Europe, I thought, in terms of all the eco certifications and getting and sourcing suppliers that were as ecological as possible. And then the 360 degree approach I take with the company when it comes to sustainability and environmental responsibility is then we look at, you know, the protection of human rights, and by everything today being produced in Europe, the EU is already known to uphold the standards of the UN Global Compact when it comes to human rights, anti-modern slavery. Then looking at then how are we shipping these garments? Are they individually plastic wrapped? Is that necessary when they get to our warehouse and we're packing everything? Like, can we source packaging that is made from recycled paper that's FSC certified? Where can we divert waste in terms of our own packaging? Like, we reuse our boxes all the time, not to the presentation of the, you know, for a customer, but to a supplier, to each other, if we're sending sampling things back and forth. And then on shipping, we partner with DHL. They have a program called Go Green. So last year alone, I think on 8,000 kilograms of shipments, we offset carbon on all of it, like 100% of our shipments. Which means that we're actually contributing extra pounds for every kilogram shipped to go to certified projects and green energy projects that are certified by DHL. And then it's like, just, I think, yeah, thinking through all of that, then it's our employees, our partners, how do we create the best experience for them? What sort of benefits are we thinking about? What matters to like the wellness and health of all of our employees and our team? It's endless. And I think it's about what we can do and to the best ability that we can do it and offer within our resources.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think it's so important to really be a leader in this as a company and be educating your consumers and really make this the normal, and that this shouldn't be an extra thing. It should be what's expected. And that's really amazing that you guys value it so much.
Sorry, Abigail, I think just to touch on like, where are we heading with that and sustainability is, and I believe the future is circular economy. So creating a system that doesn't just expel energy and resources at the end to have a finished good, but creating a system that is circular where, or closed loop, where like the energy or the carbon or the chemical byproducts can be reused. The end finished garment can be either biodegradable, that it goes back into the earth, some sort of being able to give it a second life or prolong its life, being able to ultimately, I think for us, a lot of the performance fibers, being able to break those down into their original compositions and recycle those back into the chain again. We've focused a lot on circular economy, and we're trying and always testing new fabrics on the market, but they have to also be commercially viable. So I think one of our biggest successes was starting with like our eco layer on top, which is made from beechwood trees in Austria in a closed loop process. We made it into black turtleneck and it's certified biodegradable. That became a huge instant success. That fabric we've developed into now 5 styles and 5 colors, what's called our Eco Lux Essentials. And so finding ways of either that as a fabric that became commercially successful, or where we have a goal of incorporating regenerative fibers into 50% of our future production over the next 12 months. So it's another way of creating that circular economy or a part of it. And then also we've always allowed for customers to donate their gently worn work clothes, whether dye or not, back to us using the return label that we provide, so that we can donate it onto organizations like Dress for Success. And it's thinking about that, or offering repairs for all customers in case the hem fell and they wanted, or we wanted to give them a free hem shortening so it fits them better, but giving those types of services so that they can prolong the life of their garments.
Yeah, those services are amazing. I think especially as a young person, we're not really used to having our clothing be repaired. And when you're done with it, you just throw it away. But to really be bringing those services back, I think is really important. And I wanted to touch on another aspect of really empowering women and the events that you host, whether it's career networking or styling or whatever it may be. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So when we launched 100% online, and I realized it was really important, especially when our unique selling point is the fabric itself, and we are making tailored, fitted styles, that the in-person experience was so valuable. And actually some of our best customers come through like first finding us in person, figuring out their size, having a better experience, that human contact experience. So we started a series of pop-ups called Performance Space. A space for performance of the clothes, of the women, everything. And that's actually grown in and of itself. The first one we ever did was in New York for a week. Then we came back to London and did Marylebone for a month. And now we're in Spitalfields in London by Liverpool Street. And this is a pop-up that was since November. So it's going to be, yeah, almost a year, I think, and potentially getting extended. And as a small company on a very tight budget, every time we did have to use the space and pay rent for the space, it was expensive. And so I thought, well, how do we really maximize and optimize our space and the time that we have in each of these performance spaces? And so that led to just a series of testing all these fun events or sustainability or career focused events, we tried lots of different things in the store and saw which ones, based on experience, did the best and resonated the most with our community. And it just became a thing. So by the time we got to our most recent pop-up, I mean, the schedule of events would be, you know, having at least two a week. We would invite incredible either career coaches that help women navigate through their career mobility, talking about how to negotiate your pay, to sustainability, like real experts in the industry on sustainability, to stylists. And one we had was the on-air stylist for Bloomberg TV, who hosted an event in our store. And just seeing how that adds so much more depth and value to our community and is so true to our brand and what we want to bring and give to our customers, it just felt like the right thing to do. And I really believe that nowadays, people are not buying a product from you as a brand, they're buying into your brand values. And for us, I mean, that's something that I'm so passionate about, is like, one, empowering the women and giving them this knowledge and education on everything that we think about and focus on day to day inside the company. And being able to share that with the world. And I think this ties back to also one of the reasons why when I left finance, I wanted to start a brand, because I really believe that brands have that power. They have the platform, and through their platform and voice, they can really impact change. So I feel like, you know, with this opportunity, I want us to be vocal, to be activists on the things that we really care about, and to share that with our community.
Yeah, I love how you're able to really create that in-person experience. And it's so easy, right, to start a brand online and just sell e-commerce, but to be able to have that in-person one-on-one interaction, there's really no replacement for actually being able to see those values in real life. And I know that DAI has raised its first round of funding and a lot of exciting things are on the horizon. Could you talk a little bit about where you see the future of DAI going?
Yes. So this has been quite a year for everyone. And I think within that, you know, people have had to adapt their plans, or even more drastically, some people or businesses have had to pivot. For us, it's been really evaluating the journey of our customer in this world and in the post-lockdown world. What does it mean to dress for work, or actually, what does it mean to dress for your entire lifestyle? And so I think for us, the focus has really shifted to the revolutionary intersection of work and leisure more than ever. Like, I think more than ever, clothes have to really perform, not just for your normal Monday through Friday out of the home going to the office, but in lockdown, women have had to, you know, take care of all the household work, pick up the children or school them or go to the grocery store. And as they're phasing back into work, it may be that they are having the flexibility of working 2 or 3 days from home, then to the office. But that means they also still need clothes that are going to look good for the meeting or drinks after work, but also still work for the days that they are at home and doing all of these things at home. And in none of this have I heard any of our customers say, like, my ambition has been lowered. Like, if anything, women probably have the bigger share of the household work and need to work even harder to be successful professionally and still try to remain on top of their careers. And I think for us, it's thinking about now, how do we design the clothes that are for these women that are every day, everywhere, every time? So it's like everything. And I think that's a really great and exciting challenge. I think that is for sure where our product design, imagery, styling direction is headed. And I think we have such a strong foundation for that, because it was always based on comfort and performance. And those things are not changing. In fact, I think they're more important than ever. And the other thing coming out of COVID is that people, the average sort of mainstream consumer, realizing more than ever the conscious consumption aspect of fashion. Do you actually need as much as you had in your wardrobe when you realize when you're working from home that you just need the really high quality basics that make you look and feel good? And so sustainability to me is a theme that's been accelerated within the fashion context through lockdown. And I think on that front, we are very much ahead of the curve on what we're thinking about, the innovations we're using, the textiles, the science behind all of that. And I think that is something that we're going to keep accelerating forward with. So that's the plan for us.
Post-law. I love it. And I think it's so amazing. When I feel like when we first started working from home, it was always the idea of like sweats on the bottom and your like blouse on top, but there really is no home and work anymore. And in terms of a working woman with children, there really shouldn't have ever been, whether you're jumping on the conference call after like feeding your child or whatever, and to be able to feel like you're living in your yoga pants, but you're looking professional at all times is so important. And I wanted to jump back to your just engineering background. And one of the major themes in Wall of Wonder and specifically in your story is how a STEM background can really provide you with the skills to do anything and pivot from one career to the next. And can you share how your background in ECE has allowed you to pivot multiple times?
100%. I think that was one of the best things I could have had was having the ECE background. I think in particular, it's become really apparent now. The most recent new master we brought on specifically found that my background in engineering and then finance was so different and diversified from a traditional way of thinking within the fashion industry. So I feel that I can rely on data, the facts, the black and white, and I can challenge the old way of thinking in the fashion ecosystem through a series of logical steps and through thinking about it in a very different way. And I think that brings a change and diversity to the thinking. And maybe this is the change that needs to be brought to the industry as a whole. And I think that, you know, without having that or being a creative person only and like aspiring to create the next new avant-garde beautiful design, I think that's really important and holds its place within fashion because it is very much aesthetics and design driven. But for me, it was building a brand that is based on sustainability, which is based on science. And one, again, empowering women, which is probably stemming from being one of very few women in EC and then one of few women in finance. But I think it's just been such a great and interesting journey that was intrinsic within me. And it's nice to see it being brought out or other people observing that this is such a nice, refreshing, different entrepreneur to be brought into this industry.
Yeah, amazing. And we like to use the phrase, who is on your wall of wonder, as a way of asking who you look up to, who your role models are, those who have inspired you, helped you to achieve your successes, but also helped you through setbacks. So we wanted to ask you, who is on your wall of wonder?
So who is on my wall of wonder? My dad is on my wall of wonder. And that's because he's been my role model my entire life. And I think a lot of it, consciously and subconsciously, the ambition, the drive, the lack of fear of doing something very different and changing and flipping my life upside down, I think really stems from him because I was born in Shanghai. We were there. And that was my upbringing. And he had the opportunity when I was 4 to travel to the U.S. as a first generation immigrant alone, to pursue his mechanical engineering degree, his master's here. And he left us for 3 years. And in that, he did all the hard jobs while going to school, saved up enough money to bring me and my mom over when I was 7. And so to me, like that changed my life because it gave me the opportunity that I would have never had if I grew up in China. And I just always look back and appreciate and have full gratitude for this opportunity that I have and want to make the most of it in my life, in my professional life, in my, you know, personal life. And I think because he made such a great pivot in his life as a mid-30s adult, like, I think that set the example for me to come here and really make, you know, every opportunity count and really push the boundaries and innovate and try and succeed and pursue what I love. And that to me is the biggest inspiration. So yes, my dad is on my wall of wonder.
We love that. And I think you're so inspiring to all those young girls out there, young women studying STEM and ECE. And I think they can all learn a lot from your story. So I want to thank you, Joanna, for being here today. Again, Joanna is the founder and CEO of Dyewear. And if people want to learn more, Joanna, where can they find you?
So we're on Instagram at DAI. So it's just at DAI. And our website is dyewear.com. That's DAIWEAR.com.
Awesome. And again, my name is Abigail Macaluso, class of 2020, and I am one of the co-authors of Wall of Wonder, Cornell Women Leading the Way in Science, Technology, and Engineering, now available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. To learn more about the book, check out the first episode of this season. Thanks again for joining us for another episode of Fresh from the Hill. The music for Fresh from the Hill was written, produced, and recorded by Kia Albertson Rogers, class of 2013. You can contact him at KOA3@cornell.edu. For more information about the podcast, young alumni programs, and how you can stay involved with Cornell, visit our website, alumni.cornell.edu/young alumni.